Then Rousseau adds a chilling demand.
If anyone, after having publicly acknowledged these same dogmas, behaves as if he did not believe in them, then let him be put to death, for he has committed the greatest crime, that of lying before the law.
Rousseau does not specify what constitutes behavior indicative of disbelief, and therefore worthy of death. He does specify a religion, however, which the state could not tolerate, one which denies toleration to others. The Roman Catholic faith, which according to Rousseau claims a monopoly on salvation, would be prohibited. Public authorities reacted to his works quite differently than Rousseau had expected. In June 1762, the Parliament of Paris ordered his book Emile to be burned and Rousseau to be arrested. A few days later, the government of Geneva issued a writ for the public burning of Emile and the social contract and for Rousseau's arrest. Rousseau sought refuge in a Swiss territory belonging to the tolerant King of Prussia, Frederick the Great. In 1766, Rousseau visited England with the Scottish philosopher David Hume. The fashionable circles of politics and culture doted on him. Was this not, after all, the great dissident, the famous, even notorious rebel? One man who had very definite views on this subject was Samuel Johnson. His friend and later biographer James Boswell asked him one day whether he believed Rousseau to be a bad man. Dr. Johnson considered the question.
So, if you are to talk jestingly of this, I don't talk with you. If you would be serious, I think him one of the worst of men, a rascal who ought to be hunted out of society as he has been. 3 or 4 nations have expelled him, and it is a shame that he is protected in this country.
When Boswell protested that at least Rousseau's intentions were not bad, Johnson replied,
Sir, that will not do. We cannot prove any man's intention to be bad. You may shoot a man through the head and say you intended to miss him, but the judge will order you to be hanged. The want of intention when evil is committed will not be sustained in a court of justice. Sir, Rousseau is a very bad man. I would sooner sign a sentence for his transportation than for that of any felon who has gone from Old Bailey these many years. Yes, I should like to have him work in the plantations.
When Boswell asked whether Rousseau was as bad a man as Voltaire, Dr. Johnson replied,
Why, it is difficult to settle the proportion of iniquity between them.
Rousseau's trip to England ended disastrously. He fought with Hume, who he came to believe was part of the philosophes' conspiracy against him. Most of Rousseau's last works were autobiographical, intended as self-justifications. This is especially true of his Confessions. But in one work, Rousseau pioneered yet another movement that flourished in the following century, nationalism. This was his Considerations on the Government of Poland. Around 1770, grave problems faced the vast and ancient kingdom of Poland. It was burdened by great economic backwardness and terrible legal inequalities. In 1772, Poland's neighbors began the partitions that ended Polish independence until after the First World War. In these troubling circumstances, a Polish nobleman approached the now famous Rousseau for suggestions on reforming Poland. The Considerations on the Government in Poland is sometimes said to exemplify Rousseau's more pragmatic and realistic method in contrast to the social contract. In it, he proposes slow and gradual rather than sweeping reforms. He addresses one of Poland's major problems, the institution of serfdom. Committees should be set up in each province and should meet every 2 years to screen serf families for emancipation. The virtuous would be freed. Since Poland was known as serfs' hell, and since even the reactionary monarchs of Eastern Europe were much bolder about freeing the serfs when the time came, Rousseau could be accused of a certain timidity here. But his views on Polish nationalism were far from timid. Nationalities were disappearing, he fretted, to be replaced by a kind of homogenized European. Rousseau advised the Poles to maintain or reestablish or even invent any customs which tied them together and gave them a natural reluctance to mix with foreigners. As usual, education was crucial.
This is the important article. It is for education to give the souls the national form, and so direct their opinions and tastes that they will be patriots out of inclination, out of passion, out of necessity. A child, on opening his eyes, should see the fatherland, and until he dies, see nothing else. This love makes up his whole existence. He sees only the fatherland. He lives only for it. As soon as he is alone, he is nothing. As soon as he no longer has a fatherland, he is no more.
Poles should take the lawgiver Moses as their model. Here, Rousseau praises the Jewish people, not for their cultural, intellectual, or economic achievements, but for what others have called their exclusiveness and tribal feelings.
Out of these vagabonds, Moses dared to make a political body, a free people. While this herd wandered in the desert, he instituted it in a manner invulnerable to time, mishaps, and conquerors. To prevent his people from melting into others, he gave it mores and customs incompatible with those of other nations. He burdened it with specific rites and ceremonies. He introduced 1,000 constraints to keep it on the alert and to make it forever a stranger to other peoples. And all the bonds of brotherhood which he created between its citizens were as many obstacles to its absorption in other peoples.
Although Rousseau urges a martial spirit and a readiness to die for Poland, he is careful to state that this should not entail any aggressive or expansionist ambitions. Given the precarious situation of Poland, the propagation of strong nationalistic and even xenophobic feelings may have made sense. Once again, however, Rousseau cut himself off from the progressive thinking of his day, which disdained narrow nationalism. Extreme patriotism and nationalism are more in keeping with the 19th and 20th centuries. Rousseau's last years were filled with a growing anguish and despair. Enemies seemed to encircle him, becoming more potent and more committed to his total ruin. He wrote Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, to vindicate himself. To make sure his enemies could not seize and destroy the manuscript, he decided to place it on the high altar of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in the heart of Paris. Unfortunately, the area was closed off and locked. To publicize his plight, he wrote out leaflets, which he attempted to hand to passers-by, but they refused to accept them. In his last book, Reveries of the Solitary Walker, Rousseau remembered some of his happiest moments. The times spent in a dreamlike state of communion with nature. The Reveries contains some of his most beautiful writing, but it also contains self-pity and bitterness against his foes' unrelenting persecution of him. The other philosophes did view him as an enemy, but he exaggerated their hatred and power beyond all reason. As always, he generalized his experience into a statement on the human condition.
Happiness is a lasting state which does not seem to be made for man in this world. Everything here on earth is in a continual flux which allows nothing to assume any constant form. All things change round about us. We ourselves change, and no one can be sure of loving tomorrow what he loves today. All our plans of happiness in this life are therefore empty dreams.
On May 30th, 1778, Voltaire died in Paris. As someone approached the bed with a candle to see if he still lived, his last words are supposed to have been, "What? Hellfire already?" Rousseau died approximately 1 month later, on July 2nd. He was 66 years old. His last days were spent surrounded by trees and lakes on an estate put at his disposal by yet another admiring aristocrat. He was first buried on the estate, but his body was later transferred to the Pantheon in Paris. For a while, his political writings were neglected. But with the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789, they blossomed. Different sides quoted Rousseau to buttress their arguments. Some deny that Rousseau had much effect on the revolutionaries, but Edmund Burke, the great British conservative, had no doubts.
There is a great dispute among their leaders. Which of them is the best resemblance of Rousseau? In truth, they all resemble him. Him they study, him they meditate, him they turn over in all the time they can spare from the laborious mischief of the day or the debauches of the night. Rousseau is their canon, a holy writ. To him they erect their first statue.
But Rousseau's greatest impact was on the radical phase of the revolution, when the Jacobins, led by Robespierre and his young lieutenant Saint-Just, seized control. Although not everyone now or then would agree, Robespierre believed he was conscientiously applying the principles of the social contract to a France confronted by enemies within and without. If it was necessary to strip the individual of his basic rights, to push terror to the utmost in order to achieve this, so be it. Nothing took precedence over the general will. In the 2 centuries since Rousseau's death, the debate has raged over the real meaning and effect of his ideas. Some consider him to be a prophet of democracy and the moral dignity of the individual. Others view him as an enemy of all organized society and as an infantile rebel against authority. Still others see him as an unvarnished totalitarian. Perhaps the fairest judgment on Rousseau was delivered by Benjamin Constant, the leading liberal of France in the generation following the French Revolution.
In transferring to our modern times an extent of social power, of collective sovereignty that belonged to other ages, this sublime genius, who was animated by the purest love of liberty, nonetheless furnished the deadliest pretext to more than one kind of tyranny. I will certainly shun joining the detractors of a great man. A mob of inferior minds is busy trying to tarnish his glory. He was the first to popularize the feeling for our rights. It was to his voice that generous hearts and independent souls awoke. But there is a part of life which necessarily remains personal and independent, which of right is beyond the competence of society. Sovereignty can be only limited and relative. At the point where personal independence and life begin, the jurisdiction of the sovereign ceases. Rousseau failed to recognize this truth. And his error has made of his social contract, so often invoked in favor of liberty, the most terrible support of all kinds of despotism. Rousseau had the sentiment of liberty, but not the theory.